Hello, and thank you for tuning in. You are listening to Bite Radio, that means bringing inspiration to Earth Show. For network or show information, visit www.biteradio.me or call 843-808-0777. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth Show with your host, Robert Sharp.
Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth Show. Today, my very special guest is Glenn Geskin. He is author of Shift, Indigenous Principles for Corporate Change. Many of our greatest business thought leaders proclaim that the most powerful way to transform a business is to transform its culture. In Shift, Indigenous Principles for Corporate Change, Glenn offers a culturally based process and path to help move companies from stagnation to change, from mediocrity to innovation, and from disconnection to harmony. Glenn details a set of principles that underlie indigenous societies throughout the world, principles that have kept them in a state of grace and harmony with nature for longer than recorded history can account. Shift draws on the wisdom of indigenous cultures, their teachings, and their implications for significant transformation of core behaviors, beliefs, values, and ethics. Glenn's book is available from Amazon.com, and I do have it directly in the show page description to his book there. And you can also find out more by visiting his website, which is balancediz.com. And I do have a direct link to his website as well in the show page description. So with that, I'd like to welcome Glenn to the show. Good day, Glenn.
Hello. Thank you.
Thanks for joining me. I enjoyed reading your book. I'm one of those who had that corporate background, and boy, I could relate to quite a bit of the substance of your book. I'd like to start, if you don't mind. You know, I think we should really begin by identifying what indigenous, you know, when you talk about in your book, indigenous principles, exactly what is your definition of indigenous?
That's a good place to start because it's there's a lot of confusion around that. But the way that I define it is people that are essentially original people that are living in somewhat of a tribal environment, that are living in somewhat of a close connection to Mother Earth, and that have a certain lineage that they've been passing on, not just biologically, shall we say, but culturally passing it on for a very long time. So in that context of that definition, in one respect, we're really all indigenous, because if we go back far enough, each of us, even those of us of predominant European ancestry, we're going to go back to a time when we were living in close connection to Earth and in a tribal culture and society. So we all have that in our roots. And there's not that many people that are living truly in the indigenous way today as the world modernizes more and more. But in essence, I'm referring to people that come from that lineage, that that have that strong connection to Mother Earth and that strong connection to their lineage and their traditional ways.
Okay. Well, you know, that is a great place, because it really does take into account so many different cultures around the world. One of the things also now is that the premise of Shift is that the corporate America the corporate world, you know, as well as business, really would benefit and do themselves a favor by shifting their corporate culture to one that is more in line with some of the indigenous principles. So do you, if you wouldn't mind sharing with the listeners, a little bit about, you know, what you feel the current corporate environment is, you know, and what are maybe some of the you know, just some of the basic ideas of, you know, maybe why is it that we need to shift? You know, what are some of the symptoms that we see that really should kind of get our attention as to why we need to shift?
Yes. If I may, I kind of am hearing a couple of questions in there. And
yeah.
If I may step back for just a minute and talk about language, because there's a lot of culture that's intertwined with language. And the European, Latin, Germanic-based languages are primarily based on nouns, and for the most part, indigenous language is primarily based on verbs, in the sense that indigenous people speak more in metaphor. So they wouldn't say, I'm going to go into town. They would say, I'm going to go to the place where there are many buildings, for example. And so it's very interwoven into their language is the relationship of the state of being and doing versus putting things into categorizations where we would say, I'm going to go to town, or I'm going to go to the city, I'm going to go to the big city or the little city, but they're all pretty much categorizations. And the reason why that's important to mention is that it suggests a very different way of thinking and being in the world in a very different kind of worldview. And that speaks to sort of the crux of what I feel that indigenous culture has to teach, in particular the corporate world, to help it to evolve in an amazing direction. Is that in the corporate world, in our modern realm, and in particular like in academia, we have this thing called scientific method, where we have this sort of method of inquiry and this method of discovery that's very linear and it's very analytical. And it's very much about categorizing and defining. And in indigenous and traditional indigenous culture, they don't place such a need on defining things, for example, or putting them in boxes or saying it's this or it's that. Their greater emphasis is on the state of being. For example, if you and I have a conversation like we're doing here, we're going to have this conversation for an hour, in the indigenous context, they would place less emphasis on the actual words that we're exchanging and more on the undertones beneath it and what are we exchanging in terms of emotions and what are we learning about each other through the course of this conversation. And I know this sounds maybe a little bit esoteric, but it's actually very applicable in the business because it's where we've fallen down. And to really illustrate this in a sort of very clear way, in the 1980s, many people are aware of how Wall Street and the large corporations in particular made a shift. And the shift that they made was to move away from having CEOs with a sales and marketing background and moving towards CEOs with more of a finance background. And since then, what we've seen is more of a dehumanization of the corporate world by doing so, because decision-making is reduced to more like analytical spreadsheets and numbers, things that are very tangible versus intangible. And in the corporate world, if you're a leader, if you're an executive, and you're wanting to bring forth a new project or a new division or a new innovation, and you're speaking to its intangible qualities, most often people are going to say, okay, yeah, well, what do the numbers say? And so what we're doing there is we're turning away from things that are actually even more important to our success, which is the intangibles. And the intangibles relate to not so much like what are we going to pay to manufacture this product versus what we're going to sell it, or who's going to make this product or who's going to sell it, but rather now we're looking to the value of how are people going to feel about this product, both in our company, the people that are making it, the people who are selling it to, our customers, our community, how are people in general going to feel about it. We've moved away from this place of focusing on intangibles to focusing almost purely on the tangible aspects of dollars and cents. And in doing so, what we've done is we've robbed the heart and soul of the corporate world. And it's the very thing that we need in order to take us to the next level of creativity, of innovation, of embracing our intuitive approach to doing work, of embracing the humanness of everything. And instead of looking at companies as simply financial and legal constructs, we look at them as communities and groups of people that interact with other communities and groups of people, which is a very indigenous way of approaching business.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's... I can see that explanation and how that, you know, is manifested in the business world. I mean, my background when I was in the corporate world was in banking. So, you know, for a long part, you know, so of course, you know, the dollars and cents spreadsheet and all that kind of thing. I mean, money was the business, you know, in that particular case.
Yes.
Now, what's interesting, you talk about, the intangibles and the importance of that. Do you see that maybe some of the more innovative companies, you know, the younger minds, you know, maybe employing some more of those intangibles, like, for example, Google, you know, or
yes.
You know, places where they have an environment that really, you know, focuses on creativity, innovation, and less on structure?
I do think so, and I think Steve Jobs was a great example of that. There's some really great quotes of him going all the way back to the 1980s when the personal computer was not ubiquitous at that time, and they were making a personal computer. And so they didn't really have a market to go out to and ask people, what would you like from your personal computer, because people didn't know. Moreover, they didn't even know that they necessarily wanted one. So what he directed his people to do, him and Steve, is they were developing a personal computer based on what they would want. And they had a vision. And there's this great quote, and I'm just, you know, going to paraphrase it from an interview that he gave back in 1985 when he talks about, like, a master carpenter who makes a dresser is not going to put a cheap piece of plywood on the back of the dresser thinking that, well, it'll always be against the wall and no one will see it. That's not the point. The master carpenter will see that, will know that it's there. So the master carpenter who really cares about doing quality work is going to put a nice, beautiful piece of wood on the back of it as well as he is on the sides and the front and the top. So it kind of speaks to how he approached the creative endeavor, the creative process within the early days of Apple, is that they felt that they wanted to create a certain kind of a product. And he was known for driving relentlessly for certain things in quality that he wasn't necessarily looking at the numbers. He just had a certain feeling, a certain vision. It has to be this way. And he drove it forward. Of course, as many people know, he was notoriously difficult to work with, you know, but just from a product standpoint, you know, he was really going from his gut and his intuition. And as history forward has shown, it played out to his advantage to the extreme extent, because they're one of the most profitable, successful companies in the world today. And of course, I'm a Mac user myself. And in terms of some of the newer entrepreneurs, younger entrepreneurs, there are many that are following their gut intuition about things. But still, there's a predominant focus on what's my exit plan, and, you know, when's the IPO going to happen? How much am I going to get out of that? There's still that piece of it in the back of their mind, but at the same time, there are indeed people, a great many entrepreneurs out there that are driving forward based on their creative vision and really caring about the intangibles.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I agree with you there. You know, there are those who, you know, are following their gut and still probably looking at their, you know, what their dollars and cents are going to be, you know, in the end, or so to speak. But don't you think that, you know, that just those individual examples that get cited and highlighted are kind of the seeds to create maybe a little bit more of a flow? Because this whole focus on, you know, the bottom line, dollars and cents, and, you know, the money aspect and profit, I mean, that's been pretty ingrained in many business models, really. And
yeah.
So it seems like it's going to take a long time to get that shift to go in a different direction.
Yeah, you're right. And the reason I find that it's so difficult for that shift to be catalyzed is that what we're really talking about is we're talking about a worldview that people hold. We've been given a story, you know, we can go back to the early 70s and Milton Friedman economics and all of Wall Street and all the financial publications and news media and so on that have been preaching this mantra to us over and over and over for so many decades now, and the economics schools and academia and all of it. saying that businesses fundamentally, primarily exist to derive profit and return on investment to shareholders and investors. That's become our worldview. We've accepted it. And you, as well, having spent years in the corporate world, in particular in banking, you had to accept that. If you didn't, your career was going to be very short-lived there. And I myself, I had to operate that way when I was working for large companies. Otherwise, I was going to be very much in conflict with people. So it's become something very ingrained into our thinking. It's kind of like, you know, like in my book, I use the example of Copernicus back to the 16th century, who used Euclidean geometry to determine that the Earth is actually not flat but round after all. And he wrote a book on it, and he was like, you know, his books were burned, he was put in prison, he was persecuted because of this, because everybody had it in their mind that the world was flat. Well, this is very much the same kind of thing. It's changing a worldview of something that really isn't helping us. This concept that companies existing primarily for profit is hurting us more than anything else. And yet, it's hard to shift out of it because it's a worldview. So it's kind of like we need lots of Copernicuses out there and Galileos to say, hey, wait a minute, there's another way of doing it that's not only more fun, more fulfilling, better for Mother Earth, but actually, ironically and paradoxically, it results in a higher return on investment, too. So it's not that we say we're not going to focus on money, but we're not going to elevate the focus on money above any of our other business objectives. So we're going to keep it in an equal playing field, and when we do that, we're actually seeing, you know, the Firms of Endearment book from 2007 is a great example and study into these companies that manage themselves by multiple objectives are actually 9 times more profitable than the companies that focus only on the money.
Yeah, see, and when those get, you know, those examples get more visibility, you know, I think that's what it's going to take, because it's going to take, you know, a lot of the people at the top, so to speak, you know, to be able to recognize the value and then try to, you know, make changes in their corporate culture and values and that kind of thing. One of the things that you mentioned in your book, you talked early on, is about, you know, the environmental consumption, you know, that we have. And you even talked a little bit about, you know, the idea of slavery and, you know, that we really have a lot more of that in today's environment. And it's interesting because I've seen on the news lately some stories that really talk about, you know, how we have enslaved people, you know, into various working environments that are really contrary to, you know, human nature.
Mm-hmm. Yes, very much so.
And it's one of those, I really don't think a lot of people recognize that, you know, that kind of thing is going on, of course, unless you're in it. But, I mean, to me, it's just amazing. And, you know, in the environmental aspect, I have a special series and a program called Environmental Awareness, and have had some really wonderful people on who have really worked hard to, you know, raise awareness on the environmental impact various businesses have, and in recognizing that, you know, it just can't, you know, it's not sustainable. It's not, you know, I mean, without giving back, and that's part of the indigenous principles, isn't it? The idea of what we take, we also give back a little bit?
Yes. Reciprocity is what it all comes down to in indigenous culture. In everything that we do, there is reciprocity, whether it be with Mother Earth, whether it be with our elders, whether it be between the genders, with our children, with our communities, the whole ball of wax that we focus on reciprocity, that we're always working to give at least as much, if not more, than what we receive. It's very,
yeah,
very fundamental.
Yeah, it is. And you know, right now I just see so much just the taking, and really it seems short-sighted. I mean, there's, you know, there doesn't seem to be a recognition of, you know, the long-term plan. You know, it's more of a do now and, you know, let the future kind of take care of itself.
Yeah, the Chief Warren Lyons of the Onondaga people gave this really amazingly powerful talk a few years back because he had an opportunity to meet with a group of CEOs of large corporations, and he was describing to them what he was, what his perception of what they were doing was. Is it's kind of like you're on a horse, and you're riding this horse full bore towards a wall, and you don't, you're not like pulling the reins to stop the horse, you're just charging towards the wall. And he was describing how corporate activities are like doing this with regards to the destruction and overuse and depletion of natural resources. And he said, don't you have a pull mechanism? Isn't there something in there where you can pull the horse and stop before you hit the wall? And their response to him was, no, we don't have a mechanism for pulling the horse, as you say, and that, you know, we have to, ultimately, we have to deliver a profit. And so Chief Warren Mine says to them, well, who do you have to deliver a profit for? And their answer is, for you, the shareholders. And so it's this kind of very, you know, silly and profound conversation at the same time. And he says to them, are you parents? And they all, you know, yes. And, okay, well, do you have grandchildren? Yes, sir. You don't have this many. And so on. He says, when are you going to start being a grandparent and stop being a CEO? And, of course, you know, lots of silence. And it's a very important question to ask. You know, if you're a CEO of a publicly held C corporation, you actually do have a fiduciary responsibility to deliver profits. If you want to sell off a business unit and you've got two potential buyers, you have to give it to the buyer who's offering you more money, even though the one who's offering less money might be better for the business unit, better for the environment and the community. If you sell it to the one who's offering you a lower price, you can actually be sued by shareholders for breach of fiduciary responsibility. And I don't know that enough people really realize that, that it's built into the legal construct of the corp of the U.S. corporation, that they have to keep doing this. They kind of like legally don't even really have much of a choice. So,
yeah.
But there are lots of things that can be done. And there are lots of ways of showing financially and otherwise that making changes for this, that are going to benefit people and benefit environment and benefit culture are actually financially very, very sound. It's just that, again, back to that worldview, it's so deeply ingrained that it takes an emotional, visceral kind of experience in order for people to break from that thinking. It doesn't just happen, you know, actually, it doesn't happen even, you know, from just reading a book, unless that book really evokes them on an emotional level.
Yeah, I agree. Well, you know, I'd like to talk, kind of shift now to talking about your book and some of the areas covered in the book and maybe about a few of the principles. One of the things I really enjoyed is at the beginning of each chapter you have a quote from an indigenous person and highlights the content, which is great. But I have to tell you, this one made me laugh. When I read the one for One Flying Morn, it says, growth is a painful process by Wilma Mankiller. My God, that Wilma, I bet she was a hoot. To me, I just thought that was kind of, it was funny, you know, to the sense of, you know, talking about growth being painful, and then you got Mankiller. But anyway, that was just kind of just one of those funny things that I noticed that it's kind of like so much to be said in kind of humor. But I don't know Mankiller.
Well, she was the chief of the Western Band of the Cherokee people, and she was a very famous woman, an amazing speaker and activist, and just a highly respected woman. She passed away, I don't know, I think 10 years ago or something like that.
Oh, goodness. Okay. Well, one of the things, you have a chapter in there called In Parallel, and this was one where you talk about your journey, you know, of working in the corporate world and then the parallel life, you know, working with the indigenous people. Now, I know a lot of people right now that are kind of straddling that kind of line themselves where, you know, they're maybe in the corporate world, not satisfied, recognize the limitations and the essence of what they're doing is not kind of in line with their what they want to do or what they believe should be their core values. If you wouldn't mind sharing, for those people who are out there right now kind of going through that process, what was it like for you to balance that?
It is difficult. The deeper that I went, you know, and I talk about this particularly in the chapter in The Warrior Spirit, is how integrating these principles is kind of like peeling the layers of the onion away, that were, as my wife refers, peeling the petals of the artichoke to get to the heart. And it's like if we just kind of read the book or listen to somebody talk about principles, if we just sort of peruse it on an intellectual level, we're not really peeling the layers, and it's not really going to move the needle or bring about any shift in our own life. So the reason why I'm saying that is that, you know, for all these years that I was going to these ceremonies and working in the corporate world and spending time out on the reservation and with the elders and so on, is I was peeling the layers. And at first I was just on the surface layers, and I was just really enjoying myself and enjoying everything that I was learning, and there was kind of no conflict. And the deeper I went with the principles, the more I started to see the completely upside-down nature of the corporate world in which I was working, and how, you know, upside down it was. And the more I went deeper with it, the more I came to a place to where I felt like I just couldn't do it anymore. And at least not in the same way. So I was working for a big Fortune 500 company going back 2007, and I had really kind of put it out there that I was ready to move, and I started a national job search, and I hooked up with a company out in North Carolina, a small boutique event production company that did sustainability events, and they recruited me out, and I moved out here. I knew nothing about the area in which I moved to, or didn't know any people here. I just thought, you know, I had just separated with my wife about 8 months prior, my first wife, and was really looking to get out of Los Angeles and move to someplace, you know, more rural. This was in the mountains, and I thought, this is great. And so I come out this way, and now I'm working for a small family-owned company, and I'm thinking, okay, it'll be better now. And actually, the culture there was equally as dysfunctional as the culture at the Fortune 500 company, not necessarily in the same way, but still very dysfunctional. And it still had very much to do with this underlying paradigm, this underlying worldview, this construct and thinking towards how we do business. So I was thinking sort of naively, hey, I'm now working in sustainability. I'm now, you know, sales director of a series of sustainability events, and I think I'm going to be able to work with a lot of great people, you know. And I did get to meet and work with a lot of really amazing people, but I also worked with plenty of people that were as just as much upside down culturally speaking as anyone working for, say, a bank or, you know, a financial institution or a manufacturing company. It was the same thing there, and I've seen it in all arenas within the business world. Is the upside down nature of this worldview that we have of why we exist in business, and that we actually have to do business in this particular way. And if I may give you an example that I'm only recently beginning to really learn about in a deeper way, is I've had an opportunity to work with some indigenous business people, and finding that they have similar problems, because in their thinking, and of course I'm making a generalization, they're not all like this, but in their thinking, that they feel in order to be successful in this modern business world, that they have to adopt the ways of the modern business world. They haven't yet seen that their traditional ways are compatible and actually can help the business be even more successful. So I've seen examples of indigenous business people doing business with their original principles and doing amazing things. And I've also seen them doing business when they're trying to do it the way that they think it's supposed to be done, and they're having the same problems with culture.
Wow. Yeah, well, it does seem that, you know, one of the key aspects to that is, you know, really revolves around values, you know, core values and how they're, you know, implemented in the business. Gosh, now, Glenn, we're halfway through the show already, so I'm going to take a quick break and invite anybody, if they would like to call in. If you have a question for Glenn, feel free to call in. The number is 619-789-4359.
So if you're listening in the chat room and would like for me to pose a question to Glenn, feel free to type it in there, and I'll be sure to do that. And then when you come back, Glenn, we'll go ahead and start talking about some of the actual principles that you list there in the book. So everybody stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Hey, Robert, it's Crystal Fury's time. Just want to let you know I read your book, Joy Potential. Thought it was an awesome story, and the twists and the turns were great. I felt like the characters were just really easy to relate to. I most appreciated how the book delivers some sage advice without making you feel like you're being lectured to, and without feeling like I was reading another one of those thousands of self-help books written by some spiritual guru. Very entertaining learning, and the book left me wanting to know what happens next. Thanks so much, and good luck with this book, Robert.
Hi, Robert. Evelyn here from treeofenchantments.com, my little online magical forest shop. And talk about magic. Boy, Joy Potential is truly magical. This story about a week when everything turns to a new life path, speaking of fear turning into excitement, startling new connections with others, breathtaking new thought patterns, really, I could go on and on. The ending is such a surprise. Honestly, I couldn't put it down. And when I finished reading it, I wanted more. You don't come across books like this often in life. No matter where you are, Joy Potential will open awareness and simply delight. Thank you, Robert, for a really wonderful book. I look forward to the next book, and to the next one, and the one after that. I hope many, many people read Joy Potential. They will be very glad they did.
For more information, visit www.joybook.me. That's joybook.me. Or call 843-808-0777.
Okay, everyone, thank you for staying with us. Again, today my very special guest is author Glenn Gefkin, and he wrote the book called Shift, Indigenous Principles for Corporate Change. Again, Glenn's book is available from Amazon.com, and I do have a direct link to his book there in the show page description. As well as in the description is a direct link to his website, Balanced Is. There you can read about the book, various culture workshops, services, blog, and many other things. And there, again, there is a direct link to Glenn's website in the show page description. Okay, so with that, we're back, Glenn.
Hello.
Okay, great. I'd like you guys to talk about, I have highlighted just a few. First of all, before we go on, I do want to say that, even though, the book quite often talks about corporate businesses, and we tend to maybe kind of lump them in with large business. It really does involve any kind of business, entrepreneurs, small business owners, anyone, correct?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's easily applicable.
Yeah, because as I was going through it, I was examining my business and seeing exactly, I wonder what my values are, and kind of had to go through and do an examination of that. But I think it's a valuable resource for any business person who really wants to take a close look and try and bring their work in line with some very worthwhile kind of principles. So one of the things that you talk about in the book, one of the most basic principles is the idea of connection to Earth. And the fact that, quite honestly, I don't think there, businesses really think about that, unless, of course, they're extracting from the earth. But I don't really think businesses spend a lot of time about that. And so, if you wouldn't mind talking just a little bit about, that, since it's a very basic principle of indigenous belief, how does that kind of fit into the idea of, a business environment or something that a business can do to
honor that connection?
Yes, that's a great question. And if I may just begin by saying that of all these principles, they're all pretty universal from one end of the globe to the other amongst indigenous cultures. And connection to Earth is one of the one principle that is just like so universal among indigenous people everywhere. They all have this fundamental respect for nature. But it goes more than that. But just to speak on that for a minute, obviously, being in business, one of the ways we can connect ourselves with Earth is by being respectful towards Earth in terms of our resource usage, even if it's, you know, say it's an insurance company, then trying to create paperless offices and work-at-home programs. I mean, there's all of those kind of sustainability programs that we know about that are very obvious. But there's something much deeper to this principle, too. And that is that all the indigenous elders, they always tell us that nature is the greatest storehouse of information and learning. It's greater than any learning institution or any library filled with books or database on the Internet. It's the place where indigenous people get their teachings from. I mean, there are other places, too, like elders, right, for example. But then where did elders get it from? Through connection to Earth, passed down through the oral tradition, through the elders. Also, their connection with the spirit world is another place in which they receive information. But the way they connect with the spirit world is through a connection to Earth. So it's like the starting place. So, for example, in our workshops, what we do, we don't, like, sit in a room and, you know, have a whiteboard and do all this kind of stuff. We get people out around a fire, and we sit around a fire for, like, the better part of an entire day. And we have talking circles where there's a stick that we pass around, and the person holding the stick is the person who speaks, and that's when nobody interrupts the person with the stick. And so we slow the pace of the conversation down, and we deliberately slow everything down. It's a non-electronics workshop, so everyone needs to power down and pass over their... We have to pass around a basket and collect the cell phones again, which is really hard for some people to do. You know? But what happens is, over the course of the day, excuse me, with this slower pace of communication and sitting around a fire, and fire itself has a very powerful calming effect, what we do is we slow down to meld with the pace of nature. And when we do that, we then open ourselves up to a whole different way of learning. We open ourselves up to an unfolding and an unveiling and enveloping of our intuition. So when we get out in nature, and we also have time in nature in our workshops too, and pretty short times in comparison to the types of ceremonies and things that indigenous people do, but like for even just a half an hour for people to kind of go and walk and find a place by a stream or a lake or on a rock someplace, and they're completely alone and in silence for a half an hour sitting on the ground. And if it's hot, they're hot. If it's cold, they're cold. If it rains, they're wet. And we're in nature. So we're experiencing nature on nature's terms, not trying to change it and adapt it for our own comfort, shall we say, but experiencing nature on nature's terms and slowing the pace of nature. And when we do that, we open ourselves up to this storehouse of knowledge and information that the indigenous elders have been talking about. It's the reason why indigenous cultures are so similar in their value systems from one end of the globe to the other. Because they're getting, the source of their wisdom is coming from essentially the same place, from nature. So
yeah.
To bring this back to how does this apply, you know, so I'm a CEO and I'm running a, you know, whatever kind of manufacturing kind of company, you know, what does this mean to me? What it means to that person, what it means to the CEOs or even to the C-suite executives or even to the, you know, the budding professionals working their way up the ladder is get yourself out and spend time in nature on nature's terms and slow down and do it at least once a week. And do that for yourself, if for no other reason for your own mental health, but do it also so that you can develop your intuition, your connection with nature, and so that you can tap into this whole other source of learning that is never going to be available to you through the Internet or a library or a college or university. And when we do this, when we develop our intuition, that's where the true innovation comes in. It comes from digging deeper into an emotional, visceral place of doing business, where we look at what is the core of what drives us, what do we really want to be about in our work and in our businesses and our careers. where do we really want to, what's the direction we really want to move in with our work in our world? And then we bring this intuition into it and we find what is it that we want to do, what kind of business, what kind of product, what kind of career, and we follow that passion. And we there's so many mystics and wise people that have said, you know, when you follow your passion, everything is just going to line up in your favor eventually.
Yeah, very much. Now, I am a nature lover. I start every day with my nature walk, and it's funny that the, you know, the little bits of insight, you know, that I get along the way, how it applies to really, you know, what I'm doing. Like, for example, you know, I've had many cases. I noticed in your book, in a chapter about patience, you said that that was a hard lesson for you. I'm recommending you on that one. I had one of those cases where, you know, what I wanted, a goal I wanted and then had been working toward was not happening as fast as I thought it should, you know, and it was one of those cases that, it was funny because I was walking along this one street and just out of the blue stopped, looked down on this pavement, saw a little caterpillar, you know, and it had crossed this huge street, asphalt, you know, and it was just about ready to get into the grass. And I mean, it was just, I mean, I just sat there for, I mean, stood there for a few minutes and thinking, you know, maybe this journey is like the caterpillar. I've had this long, hard road, grass is, you know, green grass is coming up, chill out, relax, you know, that kind of thing. But it was great because it just completely shifted my energy and perspective, you know, from that point on. For the day, it was like going from one of angst and anxiety and stress to one of just, you know, accepting the path traveled and also keeping an eye open for what lies ahead.
That's a fantastic example of it. And one that comes to mind, too, and I also wrote about him in the book, and I'm probably going to bastardize the pronunciation of his name, but the CEO, the founder of Patagonia, Shernard, I think is how you say it, he spent many years as a mountaineer traveling the world and hiking, camping, climbing mountains, and then starts this company. And this company has this amazing culture where they have this amazing environmental ethic and taking care of people, and they actually, like, you know, give their employees, like, funding to go and do, like, give back work in the world. And they have an amazing culture. And here's a person who spent so many years deeply connected with nature. Like, it makes sense that someone like that would have the courage to run the kind of advertising campaigns he does where they have a picture, you know, full-page ad in the New York Times, a picture of one of their coats and says, don't buy this coat. And then below is, like, reuse, recycle, and so on. So there's many other examples, too, of people that have been in connection with nature and they have their greatest epiphanies come to them there, their greatest visions come to them when they're having these kinds of moments like this.
Yeah, you know, and there have been so many times when I have been, you know, puzzled and kind of had an impasse regarding any particular, you know, any kind of block in what it was that I was working in. And it would be during those moments that it would be like, ah, now I know what to do to get beyond that. And so I can see where, you know, that, to me, I'm always, you know, promoting people to spend a little bit of time in, you know, in nature. And I used to be the kind of think that, you know, I couldn't afford to spend an hour every morning walking, you know, because I had so much to do.
Yeah.
But then now it's shifted where, you know, I can't afford not to spend that hour because it promotes so much.
And it's wonderful to hear you use that word shift because that's really what it is. You had a paradigm shift. There was something visceral and emotional in your whole concept and worldview around your time and your use of time in a way that's going to give you a benefit.
Yeah, it was. And it's kind of funny because it actually came when I was writing my first book, and that's when I would get, every morning I would get what I was going to write as the inspirational hits. If I didn't walk, I didn't get it. So, I mean, I just kind of laughed. I mean, I was kind of, if I wanted to know how the book was going to turn out, I had to walk. You know, my guides know exactly what to do to get me motivated. That was great because it, over a period of a year, you know, it became a new kind of it became a pattern for me, you know what I mean? So, and I think that's kind of when it comes to making a shift, that those are the kind of things you have to do, make those little steps, but continually doing them until they become part of your everyday routine.
Absolutely, yeah. That's what you just said is really critical is taking the steps. We don't have to, like, you know, climb the whole mountain in a day. We only have to take a step.
Yeah, very much so. Now, one of the aspects of your book, you spent some time talking about core values, and I remember when I was in the corporate world, we would constantly have this talks about what our values were, our corporate values were, and we would always come up with campaigns to shift and promote and market, you know, these are our new values, you know, or these are our values and that kind of thing. But one of the things that I thought was really interesting is that one of the things you talked about is that there's really no process of creating values. In essence, we already are living with a set of values, but it's important to identify what they are and then make changes, appropriate changes,
that
would be more respectful.
Exactly.
Yeah. So what are some of the things for if someone's out there listening right now and they want to go ahead and say, okay, now I'm going to take that step and examine, you know, what my business values are, core values are. What are some of the things that they can do to start that process of recognition of what the values are?
Yeah, there's a lot of things they can do, and that's a big focus of our workshops, as we call it, the reflection time, where we reflect on what our values are. And the way we do it in our workshops is we have these talking circles outside with the fire where we talk about it. And the whole conversation, the interplay, you know, one person says one thing, and you pick up on that, and somebody else picks up on what you said, and it's a whole ongoing conversation. To just simply just sit in conversation, respectful, slow-paced conversation about values, is a really great way to start. You know, we don't talk about them enough. You know, one of my kind of pet peeves is the principle of integrity. You know, like Bernie Madoff, right? 2008, finally we find out that this man has been scamming people for some 30 years to the tune of some $60+ billion. And it's like, wow, it took us 30 years to figure this one out. And so he goes into trial, and it's covered all over the news media, and they sentence him to 130 years or in 20 years, and so they lock him up and throw away the key, and everyone's like, wow, that sucks, and then we go right on with our life, and it's like, well, wait a minute, let's hold on a minute here. Let's stop. How did this happen? Because it wasn't all him. It was the whole system that allowed what he was doing to continue. And it was everybody, even his investors. Why was it that they were going for this as they were? And the regulators and everything. We need to have more deeper conversations about all of these principles, both within our companies, within ourselves and our families, and then, of course, broader in the, you know, geopolitical spectrum as well. We need to actually just have conversations and engage one another in a non-judgmental way, you know, because what might be integrity for you might be different for me. That doesn't make me any righter than you. It just means we have a different perspective. And maybe if we talk about it, we can learn from one another. And maybe as we learn, I might learn something from you that might make me think about deepening my integrity in one particular area that I hadn't thought of before. So conversation is a really good starting point. There are other systems, too. There's a company, Barron Values, that has systems for both large and small companies, and they're priced accordingly and so forth, where they do value assessment of companies. And they go in, and it's not just like, you know, the CEOs and the management and leadership, but it's about the entire company. And then they come back with an assessment score, and they have ranges. They've been doing this for years. They're very good at it. So that's like another way that companies can actually learn. They can think, well, we think this is our value system, but then they can do this assessment and come back with like an actual score that's been proven over and over and over to be very accurate and effective.
Yeah, that's good. You know, and I think, you know, one of the areas that you talk about in your book that you just hit on is to really take a close look at our participation in the whole scheme of it. I mean, because there's, like you say, with that Madoff example, you know, there were many participants in the whole process. And you know, that's one of the things I think that, you know, often people try and place the blame on the system versus recognizing we are a part of what that system is and exactly what role do we play and maybe how can we shift the system accordingly.
Yes. And, you know, something that just kind of pops to mind on that is back in 2004, there were a lot of people, or 2003, really pushing Al Gore to run for president again. Because there's a lot of Al Gore supporters, and they thought, you know, he's going to be the man to do it. And he was already very deeply engaged in the environmental work that he was doing at that time, and he felt like he could be more effective at changing the world, doing exactly what he was doing, than trying to run for president again. And actually, I learned something about our political system by watching that whole conversation play out on the broader perspective, is that people were looking for Al Gore, the people that are very environmentally oriented, were looking for Al Gore to be kind of their savior. They were like, well, let's get our man into the White House, and then we'll really be able to fix their problems. And it's like, I don't think that's really the way it works. We have to all accept our own responsibility, all of us, the companies, the individuals, the communities, the voters. You know, it's just like in a company. It's the same thing I've experienced before, where it'd be very easy when a company's making bad decisions to just be pissed off at the CEO for, like, you know, thinking, what the heck is he doing? But it's like, well, you know, we're all in this together. You know, yes, the CEO does have a lot of control, a lot of influence. Maybe he's making bad decisions, or maybe he's not listening to people, or whatever it may be. But
hello there. Glenn, we got you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, great. I am sorry about that. There's obviously a blog talk radio glitch that happened. I was warned earlier today from someone else that what happened to them, their host microphone just went dead. As I did as well. So sorry about that. I apologize for that.
That's okay.
I'm glad I'm in radio time back here. I'm a different line in the world working. So anyway, gosh, you know, I'm forgot where we were at, but we're down to like 6 minutes left in the show. So, I mean, this hour, that has really flown by. And there was actually one principle I kind of like to maybe finish up on. It's something, one of the things I notice is often whenever I have a show that if there's a topic that I need to really address, that something will just pop out. And you have a chapter, actually, one of the last chapters, and it's called Vigilance. And it just so happened that this morning, as I was walking, something just happened, and just so bad, the word being vigilant was kind of just popped into my head, and then as I was preparing for today's show, I was like, oh my God, look at that right there. So you must need for me to talk a little bit about that. So if you wouldn't mind, you know, that principle of vigilance, how does that fit into a corporate or a business environment that is, you know, in sync with those indigenous principles?
Yeah, well, you know, one thing I've experienced on numerous occasions in the corporate world is success being something that actually hurts us. That there's a tendency when we achieve a certain amount of success to think that, well, it's just going to keep coming, or I'll just keep being able to do what I do and I'll always be successful, and not being vigilant about focusing on fundamentals and principles and values and culture and all of these things. And in particular, you know, in the context of my book, Shift, is I wrote that chapter because I recognize that if we are endeavoring to strengthen and evolve and shift our culture, it's going to take a lot of vigilance. We can't just read a book or go to a workshop or learn this or have the, or even just have an epiphany and then think we're good now. We've got to keep at it. It's a lifetime process is what it is. It's a lifetime commitment to discovering and going deeper to continue to pull those, peeling those layers of the onion and the petals of the artichoke to get to the core of what those values really are for us. So it's extremely important. And the example comes very much from the ceremonies in indigenous society. The ceremonies are incredibly challenging physically and otherwise. These are not like, you know, having a picnic on, you know, in the grass somewhere. I mean, it's like a lot of physical sacrifice and other forms of sacrifice that go into these ceremonies. And at the same time, they're incredibly uplifting and beautiful. And the example that we can derive from these ceremonies is that they themselves are very metaphorical for our lives in the sense that when we're willing to put ourselves in a place of discomfort for a greater good, then amazing things come about.
Yeah. Okay. Well, great. Well, you know, in the last few minutes that we have, if you wouldn't mind sharing, what do you hope the reader will take from reading Shift? What do you hope that they'll take from it? And what is your goal with writing the book?
Yes. My hope and desire is truly that people will learn, or not to learn, maybe learn isn't the right word, that people will be inspired to move into a heart space connection with their values. If we just think values, if we just have intellectual conversations about values, I don't really see us ever moving the needle on culture. So if we can become inspired to move into a more heart-based, a feeling, visceral connection with our value systems to go deeper, I believe that when we do that process, that we will evolve the way that our own personal culture is, evolve the way that we go about living our lives, doing our work, doing our careers, and then as a reflection of that, the businesses that we run, that we own, that we manage, that we contribute to, they're going to change and evolve. And I believe that this is truly the most powerful way that we can change the world today, because the business world is the most largest ubiquitous force on our environment, on our society, on labor practices, on health practices, on all of these things. If we can have a major shift, a major renaissance, if you will, of the way that we do business, it's the most powerful thing we can do to change the world in a positive way today.
Yeah, great. And I agree with you. I mean, it is one of the business world, it's just one of those forces that really can shift. You know, and when we see a business, you know, taking a stand with a high set of values, you know, that are, you know, very, you know, basic tenets of human decency and care for the earth and that kind of thing, that it really does make a difference. You know, and I think, you know, in today's environment, especially in our active social, you know, interactions with people, you know, that we have on the internet, it really does create that possibility for major shift.
Yeah.
Well, absolutely. Well, Glenn, yeah, thank you for your time today, Glenn. I really appreciate
absolutely.
It. It's been a great conversation. I love your book. Again, I'll be sure to put it on my recommended reading list. And I want to talk about it quite often. So I really, again, thank you very much for your time.
Yes, thank you, Robert. It's been most enjoyable.
Great, thank you. And again, everyone, today my very special guest has been Glenn Gefkin, author of Shift, Indigenous Principles for Corporate Change. Again, his book is available from Amazon.com, and I do have a direct link to his book there in the show page description. And again, you can visit his website, which is balancediz.com, and I do have a direct link to that as well in the show page description. There you can find out about his culture workshops, his book, services, blog, and many other things. So everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And until we meet again,
thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to BikeRadio.me's Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. To become a show follower, visit www.blogtalkradio.com/BikeRadioMe and click on the follow link. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at BikeRadioMe, and our shows are also available as a free podcast from iTunes. Be sure to visit our website at www.BikeRadio.me, that's BikeRadio.me. And until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world
into the lives of those you touch.